From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Serb film director Goran Paskaljevic. His film Cabaret Balkan was the centerpiece of the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival in New York this month. It shows how ethnic and political tensions have been mirrored in personal conflicts. Paskaljevic, who divides his time between France and Serbia, has protested against the Milosevic government. Then we talk with John Callahan, the literary executor of the Ralph Ellison Estate. Callahan edited Juneteenth, a novel Ellison worked on for decades but was never able to complete. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles singer Hatta Brooks, who is now in her 80s and still performing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. For the third time in 4 years, supporters of a flag-burning amendment have won a round in Congress. The House voted to amend the Constitution to ban desecration of the U.S. flag. The measure now goes to the Senate, where it's expected to lose a close vote. It's the second day of inactivity in the Senate, where Democrats have blocked all legislative business until Republicans agree to address the issue of managed care reform. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports that frustration is building.
The Senate has come to a standstill while Republican and Democratic leaders try to negotiate a mutually agreeable way to deal with competing managed care reform bills. Democrats accuse the GOP of trying to dodge the issue by presenting what Minnesota Democrat Paul Wellstone calls an Insurance Company Protection Act masquerading as a patient's bill of rights. Missouri Republican John Ashcroft says Democrats are obstructing critical spending bills.
We are here, sent here by our constituents to do our jobs for them. Not to sit in endless quorum calls and have days of morning business because some group wants a special interest measure addressed and demands an unlimited debate without any end in sight.
The two sides appear close to agreeing to bring managed care up after the 4th of July recess, but disputes remain over key details. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
There's now a reward for turning in Yugoslavia's war criminals. The State Department's offering $5 million for information that would lead to the arrest of war criminals, including Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Angry Yugoslav army reservists today brought traffic to a halt in several parts of central Serbia for a second day in a row as protests spread to demand payment of war salaries. The World Bank today approved a controversial anti-poverty loan to China, against the wishes of the United States. NPR's Snigna Prakash reports.
The loan is intended to help about 2 million people in western China, but Tibetan activists in the United States are opposed to one of the projects it would fund. China wants to use one-fourth of the loan, or about $40 million, to move thousands of Chinese farmers into an historically Tibetan area where the Dalai Lama was born. The International Campaign for Tibet says the Chinese government is trying to change the ethnic makeup of the region, and the World Bank loan lends legitimacy to the policy. The human rights group also charges that the World Bank violated its own rules and rushed the loan through before opponents could protest. The complaint has triggered the formation of an independent World Bank panel which will review the loan. China won't get the money earmarked for the project for at least a couple of months until the panel completes its work. Snigdha Prakash, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 132 points to close at 10,534. The NASDAQ Composite Index was off 44 at 2554, and the S&P Composite was down 17 points. You're listening to National Public Radio News. At least 3 people were killed, 10 wounded in Beirut, when Israeli warplanes blew up a power station near the Lebanese capital. Steve McNally has more from Jerusalem.
Israeli missiles slammed into the El Jumour generating plant, sending flames into the night sky and plunging much of Beirut into darkness. Israel says it's taking revenge on the Lebanese for the actions of Hezbollah, whose guerrillas injured 5 Israelis today in rocket attacks on Israeli border towns. It was the latest in a series of blow-for-blow exchanges, with both sides accusing the other of targeting civilians. The strike against Lebanon's civilian infrastructure is a return to Israel's attempt to force the Lebanese government to rein in Hezbollah. The decision came from outgoing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who'll be out of office in less than 2 weeks. His successor, Ehud Barak, was apparently not involved in the decision to attack. For NPR News, this is Steve McNally in Jerusalem.
The Federal Trade Commission announced efforts today to crack down on fraudulent health products over the Internet. and encouraged consumers to be careful when looking for medical advice on the web. The commission has tracked down about 800 sites it says contain questionable promotions for disease cures. Officials say more than a quarter of those sites targeted by the FTC in the past year have either removed their claims or have been taken down. U.S. health officials said today that more states have passed laws protecting minors from tobacco products since 1995, but there's been little change in state laws banning or limiting indoor smoking. In a review of state laws on tobacco control, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says California remains the only state that has banned smoking in indoor workplaces, bars, and restaurants. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Just before his country, Serbia, was bombed by NATO forces, director Goran Paskaljevic released his latest film. The film, Cabaret Balkan, is a series of vignettes which shows the volatile atmosphere that had developed in Serbia, where ethnic, economic, and political tensions were mirrored in personal conflicts like jealous rages and petty acts of violent revenge. Paskaljevic is married to a French woman and for the past few years has divided his time between France and Belgrade. He participated in the large anti-Milosevic demonstrations 2 winters ago. He was last there 3 months ago, just before the bombing. His film Cabaret Balkan was the official centerpiece of the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival in New York earlier this month. It begins its theatrical release July 23rd. Everyone in the movie is operating on a very short fuse. In fact, the original title of the film was Powder Keg. Although he used that title for its European release, he had to change it in the States.
Here we had some formal problems because Warner Brothers registered this title for a new Kevin Costner's movie, so we couldn't use it. But I hope that my new film is not going to be Dancing with the Wolves.
That's right. You'll show him.
Yeah.
It seems to me in your movie that you're kind of saying everyone is guilty. You know, that somebody commits a wrong against somebody else, and the person who's been wronged commits an even greater wrong as an act of revenge, and things just are constantly cycling out of control in each of the stories in your movie. Are you trying to say that really everyone ends up being guilty?
Yeah, I'm trying to raise this question during the movie many times. And I think it's a moment that we ask ourselves, are we guilty for our destiny? And I think yes. And it will be very important for Serbian people to ask this question and to understand that we are also guilty for our bad luck, if I can say it like that. The only in the film, you know, who says I'm not guilty, it's a new generation. And unfortunately, they are without future. And, you know, I didn't want to say who is guilty, but already to ask this question, it's very important.
Well, you opposed the Milosevic government and participated in the major demonstrations against him. And
yes.
I guess it was it the winter of 97, 98?
Yes.
Yet you opposed the bombing. Why did you oppose the bombing of your country?
Because I don't think that the bombing can help to bombing is destruction, you know, and you cannot do bombing infrastructure and say we are not against the people. So that's create very much anti-Western and anti-American feeling, and I'm part of democratic opposition. How you can explain to the people today that our future is on the West and integrate the Europe, because it's normal that Serbia go that way and not to China, you know.
How did your parents and your children who were still in Serbia do during the bombing?
But like everybody else, what can you do? It's you are hopeless. You cannot do anything.
Were they okay? Were they hurt? Were their houses still intact?
Their houses are okay. They live in the middle of Belgrade, and the middle of Belgrade is not touch very much. I live five houses from the television building, which is bombed, and it was very hard moment for me to recognize a friend of mine who is killed in television station, one technician. So, you know, and I lived in Paris, all this bombing, and every night I watch CNN till 3 o'clock in the morning just to see what is bombed, because you cannot to sleep, and in the same time somebody can kill your kid in Belgrade. So it's really a horrible thing to live. And not productive at all. I said in many interviews just before the bombing, if that starts, that will make Milosevic even stronger. It will completely destroy also the democratical opposition. Also, a lot of lives are lost, and the country is now 50 years back economically. And you know, it's no victory for anybody, because it's just in this war, it's two big losers, and that's Albanian people and Serbian people.
Now that the bombing is over, what effect do you think it finally had on Milosevic and his popularity in Serbia?
I think that the people who were with Milosevic, they are still with Milosevic, even stronger now. And the people who are against him, they are still against him. But also don't forget the bombing created immediately the state of emergency. And that means that the opposition press don't exist, that you live under the laws, you cannot to leave country, you are limited, and it enforces his power.
I think you were already living in Paris during the anti-Milosevic demonstrations in 97 and 98, but you returned...
Yes, I left immediately Paris, and I went back to Belgrade to be with the people on the streets, because that's my... I think Yugoslavia badly need democratical changes.
Would you describe for us what those anti-government demonstrations were like in 97 and 98 that you flew back to Belgrade to participate in?
But we went to the street peacefully, and it was very important for us to show that we are ready to go every day on a demonstration asking for our rights and don't make a step to the violence. And after 100 days, we succeed, and we got the cities like Belgrade, Kraljevo, Čačak, some bigger cities in Serbia. But after that, when you take the power, you need some money to show that you are, and some support to show that the things will be better. And if you are short and the money is in the government's hands, it's not easy, you know. So I said so many times why on that moment we didn't have any support.
What kind of rights or power do you think you won after the 100 days?
Morally we won, first of all, which is very important, and the people started for the first time to feel freedom, and they were on the streets, and for the first time I saw the people that they are ready to confront police, that they are not afraid of official power. You understand what I mean? And the police created the cordons all over the Belgrade, and we approached to them and we talked to them, and I had a feeling that they are ready to pass on our side easily. So what is fantastic, it's this hope on that moment, you know. So after that, as I said, we didn't have support. And to be honest, these political leaders like Vuk Drašković and Đinđić, they started to fight between them for power, and Milošević used that immediately. So the people after that, when you have a hope, and after that immediately you understand that you are in the same situation, and that all this energy didn't worth it, these 100 days of the streets, it became very, how to say, disappointing, and that's why I badly needed to do Cabaret Balkan or Powder Keg, to show this situation.
My guest is Serbian film director Goran Paskaljevic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Serbian film director Goran Paskaljevic. His film Cabaret Balkan begins its theatrical run in the U.S. in late July. Now, I think you have a pretty interesting family history. From what I've read, your maternal great-great-grandfather was one of the writers of the Constitution when Serbia became independent in 1882?
Mm. Yes.
Were there many stories about that passed on through the family?
Not really, because, my family... It's an upper-class family, so when the communists came in the country, they paid the price, so they took the house from us, took everything. And it's an intellectual family. My father was a writer and journalist. My mother, she was a professor of history. And it wasn't easy for intellectuals in Yugoslavia, even during the Tito's period, you know. Because don't forget, Tito is a dictator also. And so we never had a period in Serbia or in Yugoslavia, a real democracy. So I think it's really very important to build up democracy in Balkans, especially in Serbia and Kosovo, in Albania, Macedonia. And if we do that, we can integrate the Europe, which is for me very normal, because culturally we belong to Europe, not just because we are Christians, but also because we have a wonderful cultural values there for centuries, you know. So it's a pity that we live like a pariah behind the world, you know.
You know, a lot of people say now, looking back, that at least Tito managed to hold people together in spite of long histories of ethnic hatred. Do you agree with that? Was your sense of ethnic difference in Serbia different under Tito than it was after
it
communism?
It was different atmosphere. He really created this atmosphere that to push back the nationalism. And for example, my first wife, she's a Croatian, and we had, I think, 2 million mixed marriages, and we started to forget our ethnics, who is Serbs, who is Croatian, who is Muslim, you know. What was wonderful in Sarajevo, it's just that mixture. But after Tito's death, we had a short period of Ante Marković. It's a prime minister who worked on idea that we stay together and that we develop strongly economy. And but unfortunately, some other leaders like Milošević, Tuđman, is it Begovic, all of them work in another direction because they build up their powers on the nationalism, which is the worst what can happen to one nation. You know,
when
it's easy if you don't have any economical program or something really to offer to your people, you just have to say you are better than others, and the others are guilty, responsible for what's wrong with you, etc. And it's easy when you create this nationalist atmosphere to have a power and keep your power, and that's the tragic what's happened in Yugoslavia. I think it's a moment now for the Serbs and others to stop looking in the back, and because our history it's full of crimes and you have to go ahead and watch your future. Look what French and Germans they passed through two wars and a lot of hate, but today they're creating a new Europe together. They have an army together. They live together in peace. So we have to follow this example. And because when I say to my friends today, look, the bombing, it's horrible, but you don't see all the informations. The paramilitary forces did so many crimes in Kosovo. And they respond to me, yes, but the Albanians did a lot of crimes against the Serbian population 15 years ago, etc., etc. I mean, if you don't stop looking the history like that, you will be always full of negative energy and destructive energy.
Which is, I think, what your film has to say also. I'm wondering, when you first started seeing political leaders using nationalism and ethnic conflict to boost their own power, how did you see that sense of nationalism and ethnic hatred surface in people that you knew, friends, neighbors, people on the buses, I mean, whatever? Like, how did you start to feel that ethnic tensions were being increased and manipulated by political leaders?
But, you know, it's a very interesting question. For example, my film Cabaret Balkan, it's the only film, Serbian film, who is shown all over the ex-Yugoslavia. And I went with my actors to Sarajevo for the premiere of the film, and it was a little bit tense, you know, the first meeting with the journalist there. But in one moment I said, listen, I'm here and I have a strong feeling when I saw this destroyed Sarajevo to apologize myself to you for the siege of Sarajevo. And when I come back later on in Belgrade, some of my friends told me, why you have to apologize? They did also the crimes against us. So many Serbs are kicked out from Sarajevo and from Croatia. And that's true. We have between 700 and 1 million refugees in Serbia, Serbs who are kicked out from Croatia, etc. But I try to explain them that if everybody apologizes to everybody, that's the way how we can live together tomorrow. If not, we will just increase the hate, you know. So how I saw that in the buses, you asked me, on the streets. The people start to repeat the arguments which are not the real arguments. If you hear on a television and a radio and you read in a newspaper something which is not a real argument, but if they repeat it 100 times, you start to believe that it's true.
What's a typical lie or argument that was, you know, used by political leaders and then repeated until it seemed true?
I can say lie, but for example, if you start to repeat that in Kosovo, the Serbians are girls are raped and they kicking out the Serbian family from Kosovo. And if you repeat that every day, many times, you increase the nationalism because the people start to react. And I cannot to say that is a lie, but if you repeat it that and you talk about it all the time in a newspaper, the Serbian says, wait a minute, what they are doing to us. And that's how you raise the nationalism. Let's take a CNN like example also. When the bombing started, Madeleine Albright said that it's going to take 5-6 days. I remember that very well. So after that, 2 weeks, 3 weeks of bombing and a lot of refugee, it's increased the refugee crisis. And CNN started to show the refugees all the time. You understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And pushes these images very much. So after that, they said, you see why we are bombing, to save those people. And the people all over the world said, yes, it's horrible. You see what's happened, all these refugees. We have to continue the bombing to save these people. But we just forget that it's 10 times more refugees after the first bomb, because that was a signal for the paramilitary forces and Serbian paramilitary forces for the revenge there in Kosovo. You understand what I'm trying to say?
Right, so you're saying that some of the pictures we saw of the refugees, that the refugees were fleeing in part because the bombing itself set off attacks against them.
Yes, and if you repeat something on television all the time, that became a fact. You can manipulate the audience easily.
Goran Paskaljevic directed the new film Cabaret Balkan. It opens in New York July 23rd, then slowly opens in other cities. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Time magazine. This week, Time examines the atrocities found in Kosovo and the international community's plans to bring war criminals to justice, and by Pantheon Books, publisher of Anne Lamott's book, Traveling Mercies, Some Thoughts on Faith, available in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the state of the Serbian film industry after the bombing. We continue our interview with director Goran Paskaljevic. Also, we talk with John Callahan about editing Juneteenth, the Ralph Ellison novel that Ellison was never able to complete. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles rhythm and blues pioneer Hatta Brooks.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Serbian film director Goran Paskaljevic. He divides his time between Paris and Belgrade. His new film, Cabaret Balkan, which was made before the NATO bombing, is about how political, economic, and ethnic tensions are mirrored in personal conflicts, petty revenge, and pointless violence. The film opens theatrically in the U.S. beginning in late July. It's already been shown in the Balkans. Do you think that your new film, Cabaret Balkan, is going to change your profile in Serbia? Do you think it will be any more difficult for you to go in and out of the country, or that you'll be any more or less popular in your country?
But the film is open in October last year, and it became a very popular film there. I didn't have any support. I didn't have any poster in the city, and I just had some independent cinema. But the word of mouth was very good, and especially young generation liked it very much. It became a kind of cult film there. The official didn't like it. It's normal. And I had already many problems because of my interviews abroad, and because I'm saying what... without limit what I'm thinking, you know. And they attacked me that I'm traitor of the nation, that I have to kill myself at least if I have any dignity. And, you know, it's... but you have to take these kind of risks. And I think that silence is sometime also... a shame in sometimes, in some difficult times. You cannot to be, you don't have a right to be just silent and because of your proper safety.
Now, are most of the actors in your movie from Serbia?
Yes, they are nearly all from Belgrade, and they are the best actors in Belgrade, yeah.
I don't imagine they've had a whole lot of work lately. What's been happening in the theater and film industry?
But it's the end of the film industry. Even before the bombing, we didn't have a lab, camera equipment, and but now I don't see how we can make films, because my film is paid by French. Canal Plus and some European foundations, and I just find 5% of the budget in Serbia. And I can find the money abroad because the people knows my work, and it's my 11th film. I had many films in Cannes, in Berlin, in Venice Film Festival. But what to do for a new generation? I have a son who is 25 and he's finishing his film school also, and I know his generation, and I saw their little video films, and I see that they have a lot of talents, and they want to talk about the problems, and they are very engaged. And but who going to support them? If they go to the West asking for some support, they will automatically said, show us what you did. And it's going to be very hard for them.
Have most of the actors who are in your movie Cabaret Balkan stayed in Serbia, or have they left?
Most of them are in Serbia, because for actors... it's not easy to they must to speak perfectly a language, they must to have some money to leave the country. And our actors, they are not the stars like American actors. They are ordinary people like the others, and that's why they fight it to be in Cabaret Balkan, because they felt this film like something really important for all of us to say. So... they are very limited, but they are all in the theaters, and the theaters are full every night. So they are mostly now in the theaters.
The theaters are full every night?
Yes.
Even during the bombing, were they filled?
And even during the bombing. It was a kind of resistance, you know.
One of the characters early on in your movie says, anybody with any brains has left the country. I'm wondering when you left, if you had any mixed feelings about leaving, in the sense of I mean, I think it's true that a lot of intellectuals did leave the country. Did you feel at all bad about leaving at a time when
I'm not a good person to pose this question. I'm love immigrant and not economical or political immigrant.
Right, because your wife is French. Right.
The French. It's natural for her to live in Paris and for me in Belgrade, so we split our time in between. But I met so many young people all over the world, Yugoslav, who left the country, and their feelings are horrible. They want to go back because this generation is an educated generation, and they would like to go back where their cultural roots are. And it's harder for them than for this first emigration 50 years ago, for example, which integrate easier because they are just economical emigration.
Would you like to move back to Belgrade sometime, or do you think that that's not likely to happen?
I will go back. Now I'm preparing a film in Mexico. I will shoot this film in Mexico probably in October, November, and when I finish the film in the spring, I will go back and probably prepare another movie in Serbia.
And
because
yeah.
if I can get the financial support, I would like to do the film in Serbia again.
Work with some of the same actors again?
Oh, yes, they are fantastic. So some of them will be in the movie, it's definitely.
Well, I wish you good luck, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Goran Paskaljevic directed the new film Cabaret Balkan. It opens in New York July 23rd and will open in other cities later in the summer. Coming up, a new posthumously published novel by Ralph Ellison. This is Fresh Air. My guest, John Callahan, is a scholar of African-American literature and the literary executor for the estate of Ralph Ellison, the author of the 1957 classic Invisible Man. When Ellison died in 1994, he left behind 1,500 manuscript pages of a novel called Juneteenth that he had worked on for four decades and was never able to complete. Callahan took on the job of editing the manuscript. His 354-page edition has just been published. The novel begins in the 1950s in Washington, D.C., as Reverend Hickman, an elderly black minister from Georgia, arrives to warn a senator, a white racist from New England, that the senator is in danger. The reverend is ignored by the senator's secretary, but he's in the Senate gallery as the senator is shot. It turns out the senator was an orphan of ambiguous racial background who was raised by the reverend, but later denied his black upbringing.
He discovers that he can pass for white, and he sees when a white woman comes into the, interrupts the Juneteenth revival service and claims that Little Bliss is her son, that's the first kind of sense he gets that, you know, maybe he is white and not black. And then he identifies that woman with the images of Mary Pickford and other white movie stars that he sees on the screen. And decides that he will be white, and he denies his blackness. And that's Ellison's theme, that Americans are headed for trouble and really destruction if they deny their connection to black culture and black experience in this country.
And he's including white people in there, that white people have a connection to the black experience and to black culture.
Oh, absolutely. That was the point. I mean, let's say Sun Raider is white genetically and biologically, but he is black in a more profound sense. And in this case, Ellison sets it up by having Sun Raider raised as a black child. For the rest of us, those who didn't have that experience, Ellison would argue that we still are somehow black in cultural terms.
What shape was the manuscript for Juneteenth in when you found it?
Well, Ellison had worked on this novel in progress, the second novel, or saga, if you want, for some 40 years. So there wasn't a manuscript. There were manuscripts. There was manuscript after manuscript after manuscript. And there were a number of different narratives within the manuscript. Some of them quite fragmentary and rough and unfinished. And the most finished and complete and coherent narrative, fortunately, was the one that was at the central narrative, the heart of the story, Bliss, Sunrider, and Hickman, and that was Juneteenth, and fortunately, that was the one that was, in my judgment, all but finished.
John Callahan, your edited version of Ralph Ellison's novel Juneteenth has been getting, a lot of criticism. For example, the review in the New York Times by Michiko Kakutani said, you know, Callahan has effectively changed the book's entire structure and modus operandi. Instead of the symphonic work Ellison envisioned, Mr. Callahan has given us a single, tentatively rendered melodic line. Instead of a vast modernist epic about the black experience in America, he has given us a flawed linear novel focused around one man's emotional and political evolution. I'm wondering your response to the criticism that you took this kind of like sprawling, riff-like novel and kind of shaved it and weeded it so that's now this much more linear presentation.
Well, we got so many metaphors there.
I know. I really overdid it on
metaphors.
That. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you did, but I think the critic in the Times has it wrong. There's not one melodic line in the first place in Juneteenth. I mean, mm-hmm. Hell, you have the senator. You have several. The senator has several melodic lines. The senator as Little Bliss. The senator as Movie Man. The senator as the senator. The senator in the present as a dying man, trying to put together and integrate all of his melodic lines or voices, if you want. And the same thing is true of Hickman. So at the very least, you have a very complex duet. As for her metaphor of about an unfinished symphony, it seems to me the form that Ellison was working with in this narrative is jazz, a succession of riffs and breaks and solos coming back to the bass line of the encounter between these two men in the hospital, with the senator dying and Reverend Hickman attempting to help him redeem himself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Callahan, and he's the literary executor of the Ralph Ellison Estate and has edited a novel that Ellison had worked on for about 40 years and never completed. The novel's called Juneteenth, and it's just been published. Did you talk to Ralph Ellison about what he was thinking about when he wrote his now famous first line to his most famous book, I Am an Invisible Man?
Oh, yeah, Ralph was very fond of telling the story about how he wrote that first line. He was up in Vermont in the summer of 1945. He'd just been mustered out of the Merchant Marine. And he was trying to write a prisoner of war novel, what he called a prisoner of war novel, a completely different novel than Invisible Man. And he was sitting up there in the door of a barn in Vermont, and he put a piece of typing paper in the machine and just, without knowing it, what he was doing, typed, I am an invisible man. And he was about to take the piece of paper out of the typewriter and toss it away, and he looked at it again and said, by God, I think I have something there. And the whole novel proceeded off of that one line.
And in terms of the actual style of writing in that, did he write to you that it was inspired from Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground?
Yes. Yes, he did. I was writing a piece about, a chapter about Ralph from my book in the African-American Grain in the mid-80s, and somewhere I got the bright idea to have the Ellison chapter preceded by a prologue in which I made connections between Richard Wright's The Man Who Lived Underground and Ellison's Invisible Man. And Ellison wonderfully and wittily took me to task on that and said, look, Wright and I were both the sons of Dostoevsky, the literary sons of Dostoevsky. And he emphasized the connection to Dostoevsky and made a very strong and accurate case about the differences between Invisible Man as a character and Wright's character, Fred Daniels.
And could you quote the line from Dostoevsky that inspired I Am an Invisible Man?
Sure. The opening lines of Notes from the Underground go as follows. I am a sick man. I am a spiteful man. No, I am not a pleasant man at all. I believe there is something wrong with my liver.
And the opening from Invisible Man reads?
I am an invisible man. No, I am not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe, nor am I one of your Hollywood movie ectoplasms. And you see there, Ellison riffing his own variation off of Dostoevsky. As he said so many times, novels are written out of other novels.
He obviously also felt a connection to Dostoevsky's book and didn't feel that their racial differences should mean that he couldn't connect to it because he was black and Dostoevsky was white.
That's right. In fact, I think you can make the case that that Ellison probably believed that the connection was all the stronger because of the differences, the particular differences. One of the things that's wonderful about Invisible Man, and I think Juneteenth, is that the specificity of the African-American experience that Ellison gets into these novels makes it easier for people that are not literally African-American to connect with the characters and the experience in those novels. I remember my own first encounter with Invisible Man. I was, I think, 19 years old. It was 1960. I was up at Holy Cross College, and I had read Joyce, and I had read Fitzgerald, and I had identified strongly with those Irish Catholic characters. And I read Invisible Man, stayed up all night to read it, read it through the middle of the morning, cutting a class in Tacitus, and which I was hanging on for dear life to a D. And I identified more strongly with Invisible Man than I did with the characters of Joyce or Fitzgerald, because he felt an outsider where he was supposed to feel at home, and so did I. And then what was wonderful for me, this was the time the sit-ins were just stirring my generation's roots, and Invisible Man said, "Hurt to the point of abysmal pain, still I must emerge." And I felt, my God, if he can do that, so can I.
How did you interpret that sentence?
That even though I am hurt to the point of abysmal pain, to the point of facing and being on the edge of the abyss, I still can and will emerge and try to play a socially responsible role in the larger society.
Well, John Callahan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
John Callahan is the literary executor of the Ralph Ellison Estate. Callahan's edited version of Ellison's uncompleted novel, Juneteenth, has just been published. Coming up, the sophisticated rhythm and blues of Hatta Brooks. This is Fresh Air. Hatta Brooks is a living legend, a still vital link to the sophisticated nightclubs of the early 1950s. Although she never scored high on the charts, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about a career which saw her recording everything from boogie to ballads.
I was when you were mighty glad to have me around you. That's when I found you. time was when you used to baby me all day, and then you went away. I knew you wouldn't stay. Time was when you were mighty careless with my money. You were funny. You said the best was none too good. Then you went away. I always knew you would. Time was when you said lots of pretty things to please me. You'd never tease me. You called me baby doll and lots of dirty names too. Now you say that we're through. Then after doing all those dirty things like that, you packed up all your clothes and left your baby flat. But I can remember when there was a time.
The smooth, sophisticated sound of post-war rhythm and blues is being rediscovered these days, with the music of Nat King Cole and the late Charles Brown, among others, getting deserved attention from a new generation. So it's probably a good idea to remind everyone that one of the pioneers of the genre was a unique black woman, Hatta Brooks, who's still going strong today. She was born Hatta Hopgood in 1916 to a wealthy Los Angeles family. Showing talent on the piano, she was given piano lessons and continued them all the way through college. After graduation, she married Earl Shug Morrison of the Harlem Globetrotters, but he died a year later. Distraught, back in Los Angeles and at loose ends, she worked as an accompanist in a dance studio and occasionally demonstrated pianos at local music stores. It was while doing this in 1945 that she met Jules Bihari. Bihari is best known to us as the co-founder of Modern Records, the pioneering independent rhythm and blues label in Los Angeles that he ran with his brothers. But the day he met Hatta Brooks, he was servicing jukeboxes. Entranced by the woman, with her movie star looks and flying fingers, he offered her $800 to record some boogie-woogie records for him. She said yes, took the name Brooks, and Modern Records was born. Bihari and Brooks were soon lovers, but Bihari insisted they keep the relationship secret. He thought that her being seen with a white man would sink her career, although she disagreed. Finally, after 5 years, they broke up, she left Modern, and found that she was in demand. She appeared in several films with the likes of Humphrey Bogart and Kirk Douglas, singing and playing the piano, and eventually added a new dimension to her repertoire.
Trust in me in all you do. Have the faith I have in you. Love will see us through. As long as you trust in me.
In 1952, she signed with OK Records and released All Night Long as her first single. But she also kept her hand in with more up-tempo material.
Jump back.
Seen my baby home last night. Jump back, honey, jump back. Held his hand and squeezed it tight. Jump back, honey, jump back. Heard him sigh, a little sigh. Seen the light gleam from his eye. And a smile go flitting by. Jump back, honey, jump back.
Jump back.
Jump back. Jump back. Jump back. Jump back. Jump back. Jump back. Jump back. Jump back. Jump back.
Jump Back, Honey was a fine record, so fine that it was immediately covered by several white artists, a problem which was to plague Brooks and many other black artists of the time. And although it was the sophisticated stuff that made her name, she was present on one truly gut-bucket record of the day.
Here come old evil chick always telling everybody she come from Chicago. Got Mississippi written all over.
You better stop trying to run my business.
Look who's got business.
Well, I'll have to do what I hate to do.
Go ahead and do it. Ain't nobody scared of you.
better stop trying. Run my business.
Somebody need to run it before they run you out of town.
Oh, I'll have to do what I hate to do.
Nothing you can do. Never could do nothing.
Cause I'll talk about you low down and dirty.
Blabbermouth.
Everything I'll say will be true.
I bet not never let the cat out the bag on you, child. You'll be ruined.
Her catty comments on Big Maybelle's Gabbin' Blues make it a classic. Gabbin' Blues was also the only record she appeared on to make the rhythm and blues charts. Like Nat Cole, she was aiming for the pop market and the supper club circuit, and so records like All Night Long were more typical.
I wanna love you all night long. Nobody but you. All night long. I want to give you a whole lot of kissing. I want to give you the love you've been missing. I want you to know that I love you true. And I'll do most anything for you. You'll never be blue.
In 1953, she became the first black woman to host a television show syndicated in Los Angeles and San Francisco, recorded live with her singing and playing. But this failed to launch her career to another level, probably because the idea was so far ahead of its time. And by the end of 1954, she was off okay, playing occasional nightclub dates. And finally, a few years later, she retired to watch rock and roll storm the rhythm and blues charts. In 1987, a journalist found her living in her old neighborhood and happened to mention the fact to Alan Eichler, who managed a number of top drawer singers. And since then, her career has revived. She's still got her vocal and pianistic chops, and although she's now in her 80s, she's performing live to an audience that rarely gets to connect so directly with this era of music.
Ed Ward currently lives in Berlin. Most of the music we just heard is on the CD Hatta Brooks, Jump Back, Honey, The Complete OK Sessions. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Joan Tuohy Westman. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of White Oleander by Janet Fitch, in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, actor Peter Coyote looks back on his life in the 60s and his pursuit of absolute freedom, what it felt like, what it taught him, and what it cost. His memoir has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.